When Mahmoud Ahmadinejad spoke at the UN last week, our next guest, Houman Majd, acted as his translator. Mr. Majd is the son of a former Iranian diplomat and the grandson of an Ayatollah, and although he was born in Tehran, he was raised and educated in the West. His dual citizenship has allowed him to travel frequently between the U.S. and Iran, giving him a rare window into Iranian culture, politics, and everyday life. He's put his experiences into a new book called The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, The Paradox of Modern Iran. It's published by Doubleday, and I'm pleased that it brings Houman Majd to the show today. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Wouldn't President Ahmadinejad have thought of you as a Westerner? Doesn't he travel with his own translator?
He doesn't, actually, no. And he does think of me as a Westerner, yes. But President Ahmadinejad has actually tried to own the Iranians abroad, westernized Iranians, very much with a view to his own reelection campaign next year. He wants to be seen back home in Iran as being very open, very liberal, open-minded. And so it doesn't really bother him that, you know, a so-called Westerner would be in his camp during the UN General Assembly.
Well, how much English does he know? Would he know if you had changed something he had said?
Oh, he would, yeah, but he can't really hear the speech when we're at the UN.
Because you're doing simultaneous translation.
Well, it's simultaneous. I do actually have the speech the day before, because what happens is when he flies in on a Sunday night, for example, as he did this year, and his aides bring the speech, and we spend basically all day Monday translating it into English, even though they have a rough English translation that they've done in Tehran, which tends to be pretty wrong. So,
but you're not given any opportunity to make suggestions.
Oh, yes, we are. Yeah, absolutely. It takes about 10 hours to translate the speech because there's a lot of phone calls back and forth to this hotel. Well, this is what you said in Farsi. This is what we think it should say in English. And then I've made a few suggestions in the past. This year, I didn't make too many suggestions. I thought there's no reason to, save him.
So sometimes when official translators are employed, they'll refine what's being said to make it sound nicer or more diplomatic than the original. Have you ever been asked to do that?
No, not at all. In fact, quite the opposite. In the few instances in the past, like the last year and the year before, when I've suggested that we might do that, the response has been, well, that's not what he wants.
In fact, in some cases, he wants to be as provocative as possible.
Exactly, exactly.
So what goes through your mind when you translate inflammatory claims such as his insistence that the Holocaust didn't exist or that Zionists were behind the current economic crisis?
Yeah, well, that's just – I mean, it was hard to suppress a laughter when I was actually at the UN doing it because it was so preposterous. Those claims were so preposterous. He didn't actually this time say the Holocaust didn't exist.
No, this time he's blaming the Zionists for
it. He's just blaming, yeah. And there, you know, he has a handful of aides. I think he's really quite uneducated about world history. And he has a handful of aides who are unfortunately, you know, somewhat thuggish and probably very anti-Semitic, who have told him things like, well, you know, the Zionists have read him portions of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is unfortunately, you know, in his case, he takes, you know, he considers real.
Even though it's a forgery by the
obvious forgery, yeah.
Russian police, pre-revolutionary police.
Exactly.
So you think he believes everything he says?
I think he believes a lot of what he says, yes. He also believes he's not anti-Semitic. He doesn't believe he consistently says that anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism are two completely distinguishable things. I think that he veers into anti-Semitism. Personally, I do, and I've said this to his aides, and I've suggested it, you know, that as far as Americans are concerned, even if you disagree with that, that you should be aware that many of the things that you say are going to be considered anti-Semitic.
Do you think it plays well back home?
I think it does, yes. Yes, I think it does. And it plays very well in the Arab world, where he wants to have a lot of support.
My guest is Houman Majd. His book, The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, The Paradox of Modern Iran, published by Doubleday. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You talk a lot in your book about ta'aruf, the distinctly Persian form of small talk. Can you tell us a bit about that practice and its importance to Iranian culture?
Yeah, I think it's something that exists in all cultures. in Iranian culture, it's a fine art. It's really an art, the art of politeness, for want of a better word.
How is it different than when we might say to somebody who's invited us to dinner, this is delicious, when we really think it's
awful.
Oversalted?
Yes, yeah. Well, that definitely is part of it. But in Iran, it is such a fine art that it encompasses everything, not just social manners and social encounters. It's a way for people to hide behind this polite language. But if you're aware of it and if you understand it, you understand actually what they're really getting at.
So you're reading between the lines all the
time. Always reading between the lines.
But since I hate to keep on going back to Ahmadinejad, since he is incredibly blunt in what he says, is he purposely ignoring this tradition?
No, because he actually does use tarof all the time. Sometimes he uses the sinister form of tarof, which is kind of the opposite of what tarof is, but is still tarof. He will say things, he'll compliment someone very highly, a journalist or something like that, someone who's asking him questions, and then he will turn around and destroy them in the same sentence virtually. So he uses it all the time. The bluntness is intentional. The bluntness when it comes to things like Israel and America is intentional because it's something that Iranian leaders have not employed over the past, in the past 20 or 30 years to the extent that he has. So that is, yes, intentional, and it doesn't include tarof in some places.
What about Farsi itself? Does it have certain qualities that other languages don't? I remember speaking to Orhan Pamuk about Turkish, and it has a number of tenses. It has a hypothetical tense, if I remember correctly,
yes,
that allows for all sorts of stuff that doesn't translate particularly well.
It doesn't translate. I mean, Farsi is like that. And a perfect example is, and I said this to Ahmadinejad's people last year as we were walking over to the UN, when Ahmadinejad denied the Holocaust, the way he denied the Holocaust, and we took it as a denial, he didn't consider it denial. Why? Because in Farsi he said, "Agar," which means if. The translation is if. If the Holocaust happened, then why did the Palestinians have to pay the price? In Farsi, the meaning can be and is, in fact, if you're using...
I'm just throwing out this idea.
This idea that it's not... I said to them that your big problem was that you used the word if. If you had said the Holocaust happened, but why do the Palestinians have to pay the price, I think you wouldn't have gotten the flak or the anti-Semitism charge against you. And it was very hard for them to understand that. They said, but that's the way you argue. You say, if something happened, if then...
But isn't international diplomacy, doesn't it require an awareness of how other cultures read things? I mean, if you're talking to somebody from Nigeria, you don't use a Western locution. That might be perfectly fine, but that might really be totally insulting in Yoruba.
Absolutely. And the thing about Ahmadinejad is that his administration and the people that he has brought into power with him in his administration have no background in diplomacy.
But I also get another sense that Iran, because it has such an incredibly proud history, in the same way that some other countries, France has been accused of this, the United States sure has been accused of this, feels that it is the center of the world. And so it has no need to adjust.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's that element certainly with the Ahmadinejad government. There certainly is. I mean, he goes on about Iran being the world's superpower, which is patently nonsense.
Although tomorrow we'll speak to a CIA operative who says that Iran is on its way to becoming a superpower.
But all that just feeds into those kinds of people in Iran who actually are starting to believe that Iran is a superpower. The reality is it's not a superpower and it's nowhere near being a superpower. So, yes, there is an element of pride and, arrogance that comes with that pride with this government, the government of Ahmadinejad.
Going back to the language, you say that another example of how Farsi translates differently is when we say that Iranians will yell death to America. They're not saying the same thing that we would interpret death to America to mean?
Exactly. I mean, they are saying death to America, Marg bar America. You've seen it on television many, many times. And the correct translation is death to America. But, Iranians are given to hyperbole, and death to doesn't necessarily mean we want it destroyed and over and killed. It's more down with. A better translation is down with.
But somebody who is a Farsi speaker would understand that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and that's why American journalists, when they're in Tehran, if they're in Tehran, they happen to be at a demonstration where people are shouting death to America, and they turn around and they talk to someone and they say, well, we don't mean you. We don't mean you. We don't mean America. We don't mean death to. They'll actually say it to them.
How do the qualities of the language affect the poetry that's written in it? Because Iran has this great history of poetry.
Yes, and you have to be I think Iranian poetry is basically not translatable, Persian poetry. And I mean, obviously, many attempts have been made, and a lot of the poetry written in English, is Coleman Barks is a very good example, who's translated Rumi, is wonderful as English poetry almost.
But Rumi would not recognize his poems?
Probably not recognize them if there was a way to translate them back into Farsi from English, yes.
And when do we use Farsi and when do we use Persian? Are they interchangeable?
I think so. In the Persian language, the name for the language is Farsi, which is why I use it. A lot of Iranians would disagree with me and say, well, no, Farsi is not the correct term in English. What it should be is Persian. But I think because we say Farsi in Farsi, I'll say Farsi.
Well, also Persian is one of those words that has a lot of it's freighted with all sorts of implications, historic implications.
Absolutely.
Positive and negative. Positive,
yeah, but mostly positive compared to Iran, I would say. Most people who have any knowledge of history know that there was a glorious empire, which obviously didn't do everything perfectly well, but was a big empire and had some great architecture. And Cyrus was a great king who, his first declaration of human rights back 2,500 years ago. So there is this history of the Persian Empire, which is generally better than Iran.
Some historians claim that the Iranian culture is still influenced to some degree, to a large degree, by the legacy of Zoroastrianism, even though the country's been a Muslim country for many centuries.
I think that's true. I think that's absolutely true, yes. And partly the reason for Iran being Shia as opposed to Sunni, I think, is because Iran was a Zoroastrian country, which was a monotheistic religion.
Now, why would it have chosen Shia rather than Sunni because of that?
But to separate themselves from the Arabs.
So it's simply that we are not. we're an Indo-European people who came from the north. And
yes.
So we're different from all of those indigenous people?
Exactly. But I think
This is like the upper castes of India, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Exactly. But I think, I mean, a lot of
the Brahmins.
A lot of Ayatollahs would disagree with me that that's the reason. But I think there is this sense of pride that we are different from the Arabs. Iranians tend to be, unfortunately, quite racist towards the Arabs. And the idea that our form of religion is distinct and different from the vast majority of Arabs is, I think, a source of pride for Iranians.
A reason that Iran fought so hard against the Arabs in Iraq?
Well, yes, although it also happened to, unfortunately, fight against some Shia Arabs in that case because Iraq has a lot of Shias, although there were plenty of Shia refugees in Iran at the time, including basically the current Iraqi government, which were in Iran. And there was quite a few Iraqi Shias who chose to fight on Iran's side against the Saddam's army.
Humam Majd not only has dual citizenship, Iranian and American, but he also has a kind of a dual career because he's written quite a bit about Iran, but he's also been executive vice president of Island Records and head of film and music at Palm Pictures. He's written a book called The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, The Paradox of Modern Iran, published by Doubleday. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Humam Majd. His book, The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, The Paradox of Modern Iran, published by Doubleday. So where does that title come from?
Well, I think it was a phrase I used in my original proposal to Doubleday. I think what it means is that I was trying to get across basically that Iran is not the monolithic culture that it's portrayed to be, even amongst the Ayatollahs. Obviously, there are plenty of people who disagree with each other.
The former president, Mohammad Khatami, was an Ayatollah as well.
He's
well
not
at least
Ayatollah.
He was a cleric.
Yes, he was a Hojatullah.
And he went up against a number of the other clerics.
Yes, and there have been other Ayatollahs who have gone against other Ayatollahs. There are lines that one cannot cross because Ayatollahs are not completely immune. There's an Ayatollah in prison currently, actually, for crossing the line of actually saying that politics and religion should be separate. And Ayatollah Montazeri, Grand Ayatollah Montazeri, one of the greatest Ayatollahs in Shia Islam, was under house arrest for many years. He's not anymore. But they do beg to differ.
Well, to some degree, this is because of the nature of Islam, isn't it? Where each cleric is allowed to provide his own interpretation.
Correct. It's the nature of Shia Islam. Because in Sunni Islam...
But imams have different interpretations in Sunni as well.
They do, but theoretically in Islam there shouldn't be any... there shouldn't be a cleric class. The Shias obviously have one, and the Ayatollahs are... yes, they have their own interpretations of the Quran.
And you're the grandson of a grand Ayatollah. What was your grandfather's role in Iran?
Well, he died well before the revolution. He died about 5 years before the revolution.
Would he have had to work with the Shah then?
He refused to work, actually, with the Shah's father in the 1930s. In the 1930s, the Shah's father, emulating Ataturk of Turkey, actually passed a law that women have to remove their hijab and men have to remove their turbans, because not only Ayatollahs wore turbans back then. And he refused. He was a professor at the university. He refused to go out of the house without his turban. So he actually opposed the Shah's secularism in that regard.
And then your father was a diplomat.
My father was a diplomat for the Shah's regime, yes, yes.
At one point, weren't you thinking of following in his footsteps?
I absolutely was thinking of following in his footsteps. The revolution put an end to that idea.
Well, the revolution, again, was not a monolithic thing, although the Ayatollah Khomeini wound up coming out on top. There were all sorts of different groups that thought that they were going to gain from that revolution. They had in common their opposition to the Shah. And then it was only later when they realized that it wasn't their revolution that they had supported that the trouble occurred for them. Many left.
Yes.
In 1979, you had to choose between whether you wanted to go back to Iran. You were out of the country at the time?
I was in America at the time, yes, yes. I had to choose whether I was going to go back or to stay, as it happens, illegally for a while, because one, as an Iranian, one didn't know what one's immigration status would be. But at that time, it was rather confusing. First of all, in 79, the revolution happened in February. By June of 79, Iran had become an Islamic Republic. It had started out as a provisional revolutionary government of Iran, which was not Islamic, but Ayatollah Khomeini wanted a referendum, and the referendum was a yes or no referendum. Do you want an Islamic Republic, which was overwhelmingly voted for by the Iranian people and in a legitimate vote. When it became an Islamic Republic, I, as a Westerner, there wasn't really a place for me in Iran.
What about the fact that your family had been linked to the Shah?
That was problematic to some degree in the early days of the revolution, but that kind of dissipated quite quickly.
Well, but here you are, the secular man who speaks English with an American accent. Are you welcome back?
Now I am, yes. Absolutely, yeah. Now I am.
Because of your connection to Ahmadinejad? Or?
No, not because, certainly not because of my connection to Ahmadinejad, no.
Well, people see you, they've heard that you have translated for him.
Yes, I don't think that's, they also know that I've translated for President Khatami as well, and they know that I have a close relationship with him. And, I've interviewed him and have accompanied him on his travels in America. I was actually an advisor to him for his trip in 2006. So it's obviously not the same camp as the Ahmadinejad camp. No, it's just because the Iranian government now feels very, very secure. The system feels very secure and feels no threat from people like me.
And were you surprised when Khatami lost to Ahmadinejad?
He didn't lose to Ahmadinejad.
Well, what he stood for lost to Ahmadinejad.
Oh, what he stood for, yes. He couldn't run again. He had been president for 8 years, so he wasn't running against Ahmadinejad. What he stood for, it wasn't really a surprise because the reform candidate was a very, very weak candidate, Mostafa Moin, who lost in the first round. So in the first round, it became the result was that Rafsanjani ran against Ahmadinejad and lost.
Although it also seems like the elections are stacked because so many qualified candidates are just as qualified.
That's correct. Although the Iranians will argue that they have, in the first round of the presidential elections, they had 8 candidates, and in America, basically, we have 2. They will argue that it's stacked here. If somebody wants to run, sure, they can go and run, but how do you get on the ballot? And there...
Well, we had a lot of candidates running in the primaries.
We have a lot of candidates running in the primaries, and that's the way they view the first round of the election as kind of a primary system.
Although I do get the sense that Iranians are looking at the rest of the world and saying, hey, we're being bad-mouthed unnecessarily. We're just as good as everybody else.
Some Iranians are saying that, although obviously the dissidents and the reformers would not say that. They say, well, in some cases, the West is right to badmouth us.
Well, you talk quite a bit in the book about the difference between Iranians' public and private lives. Is that a gap growing?
I think it's a gap that's been there ever since the revolution, obviously, because there is basically – there is no public life anymore. There wasn't a public life, certainly at the beginning of the revolution. If the gap, I wouldn't say it's growing, actually it might be getting less. Because, for example, a lot of the things that one couldn't do publicly up until the Khatami regime, one can do now. For example, I was in Tehran just 2 or 3 weeks ago, and you know, you see on the streets of Tehran boys and girls walking together who are clearly unmarried and would have not dared hold hands.
But they're walking together. But
they're walking together, or on a girl on the back of a motorcycle. You know, people don't wear the helmets, and you can tell who's who and who's doing what.
But she's still wearing the hijab.
Yeah, and the scarves tend to fly off in the wind. I've seen that a lot too. Yeah.
And should we assume that in many cases what's underneath the hijab is rather Western dress?
Oh, nowadays you can basically see the Western dress. They just wear something. They're not wearing chadors very often. They're wearing very flimsy, what they call mantos, a kind of an overcoat to wear over the jeans and T-shirts and stuff like that.
Yeah. What about those other things that we've heard about going on behind closed doors, drinking, drugs?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Everything that is available in America is available in Iran.
You said that Ahmadinejad wears sweatsuits and other inexpensive clothing to show Iranians he's just a regular guy. And he doesn't wear a tie. In fact, none of the people in the hierarchy wear a tie. You're wearing a tie.
Yes, yes. You can wear a tie in Iran, but if you do wear a tie, it's kind of a statement against the system in a way. In the West, they obviously respect people who wear ties. But in Iran, if you wear a tie, Ayatollah Khomeini at one point early in the revolution, and if anybody remembers, the first prime minister of Iran, Mehdi Bazargan, wore a tie. Bani Saad wore a tie. Sadegh Qutsadeh wore a tie, the foreign minister, the first foreign minister. But somebody told Khomeini that this is a Western thing, it's a bad thing, so please give us a judgment on this. And he said, yeah, the tie is bad because it's not only Western influence, but it makes a symbol of the cross.
It's interesting that diplomats from all over the world, not that it should be, all wear Western dress. A Saudi ambassador is wearing a suit with a shirt and tie. Maybe back home in Riyadh, he is wearing more traditional dress.
Correct. But the Iranians like to show the world that they don't care anymore.
My guest is Humam Majd, M-A-J-D. His book, The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, The Paradox of Modern Iran, published by Doubleday. How much power does the president actually have? Khatami didn't seem to have as much power as one might have hoped. Does Ahmadinejad have more, or does it ultimately reside in the top ayatollahs?
Khatami had as much power as Ahmadinejad does. The difference between them is that Ahmadinejad's, you know, his bark is much louder. So people assume that he has a lot more power. He has tried to assume more power, although he can't really. The reality is that under the system of the Islamic Republic, the supreme leader has the power and not the president. The president has the ability to manage the day-to-day affairs of the country.
People were confused by Khatami at times because he sounded like he really wanted to change things and ease things, and then suddenly he'd make this very hard-line statement. And it was explained in the Western press as, well, he caved into the top ayatollahs.
That's correct.
That's actually what was happening.
Yes, that's correct, yes.
So how does the supreme leader get elected or appointed?
There's only ever been two supreme leaders. It's the basis, the fundamental basis of the Islamic Republic of Iran. It's called the Velayat-e Faqih.
So this is only since the Ayatollah Khomeini?
Only since Khomeini. And it's in the constitution of Iran. Velayat-e Faqih means rule of the jurisprudent. And Khomeini was the first natural supreme leader. When he died, Ayatollah Khamenei, currently the supreme leader, became the supreme leader. He was elected by the Assembly of Experts, which is a body which is elected by the people, a body of clerics, elected by the people who can choose, impeach, remove a supreme leader.
You had a career in the entertainment business. I mentioned it earlier. And Iran has one of the great cultures of the world and also has one of the great film traditions mm-hmm. of the world, including some of our top filmmakers. Kiarostami being perhaps the best, but there's any number of them. And I remember talking to a filmmaker who'd made a wonderful movie, but it was censored constantly, who had established a career here and then gone back because he missed Iran. And he fought and fought and fought to make movies. He finally was allowed to make a movie and then was censored. But that is part of the irony of this country. He said, he didn't understand why the censors allowed him to make the film, and then he didn't understand, and then he did understand why they said no when yeah. Father was made. Still, do you think that your interest in the entertainment business grows out of your Western side or this other thing that is, you know, the whole Iranian cultural side?
That's the first time anybody's asked me that. I've always assumed it's out of my Western side, growing up with Western pop music, for example, and Western cinema. But yes, I think now that you mention it, there may be some kind of attachment that exists in our DNA to the artistic arts, the arts of Iran, let's say.
Have you ever wondered why so many good films have come out of Iran?
No, I've never wondered why, because I think I've seen a lot of talent in Iran, but I've always wondered, been amazed at how well they're received abroad, because they are very peculiarly Persian.
Although there was that silly situation where Catherine Deneuve gave Kiarostami an air kiss when he was given the award at Cannes. And when Kiarostami came back home, he was censored.
Yes, yes.
Censured for doing that.
Yeah.
Is life easier in Tehran than it is in other parts of the country? Often the capital,
probably
the situation is a bit more relaxed.
Depends on what you want to do, yes. In terms, if you're secular, yes, life in Tehran is easier. But, you know, even in the most religious small towns, you can find whiskey if you want whiskey quite openly. When I say openly, obviously, you know, there's not a market to go and buy whiskey or a liquor, but it exists in all the – but yes, life is easier in the capital than it is in most towns.
Regularly I read articles in American newspapers that suggest that Iranians secretly want to return to the old days with the Shah, at least culturally, that they really love Westerners and they love Western culture and they love foreign-made products. And then I see the vote for somebody like Ahmadinejad and the fierce nationalism that seems to be quite a major part of the country's sensibility. So is this just wishful thinking when we think of Iranians as being nostalgic for the good old days?
It's partly wishful thinking and it's partly misunderstanding and not understanding even the concept of Tarof. When Western reporters go to Iran, they tend to stay in northern Tehran. They tend to meet with intellectual Iranians, the upper class. And even if they meet with the working class or the religious class, they're always going to say that we love America. We love the old – we love everything about America. There's nothing we don't like about America.
We miss the movies.
We miss the movies. All the things that will make that reporter or that writer – things that he or she wants to hear. The reality is that, yes, it is true to some degree. There are probably, 2, 3, 4 million people in Iran who feel that way, who are nostalgic, if not for the Shah himself or a monarchy, at least for the social freedoms that existed then. But, you know, in a population of 70 million people, they're still a small minority. Even in Tehran, which is 15 million, has a population of 15 million, there's probably no more than 2 or 3 million who feel that way.
Well, what is the legacy of the war with Iraq where so many people died? There's still a huge population, 70 million people. But is there a lost generation?
Yes, there is a lost generation. You definitely get that sense when you're Iran. The war is never out of sight and out of mind. It's always present. Sadly, as is the case with many wars, the generation that got lost were tend not to be from the intellectual and educated classes. Many people, Ahmadinejad himself, who was a university graduate, did not see combat during the war. As an engineer, he did go to the front lines, but he was an engineer, so he was in far less danger of being killed. But yes, there is a lost generation.
A listener wants to know if the if-then expression is part of the Farsi language.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So it's all if this,
then that.
Then that.
It's like it's the way you...
That's a Zoroastrian thing.
It could be, yes.
Well, light and dark.
Light and dark. If this, then that. It's also, you know, in philosophy arguments, there's the if, therefore, even in mathematics.
Humam Majd's book, The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, The Paradox of Modern Iran, is published by Doubleday, and I get a feeling that the paradoxes will continue. Do you see a relaxation at all? We have 5 seconds for you to tell me.
Compared to when?
Now as opposed to 5 years from now.
Oh, yes. I see. Yes, in the future, absolutely.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.
On tomorrow's show, a former CIA operative explains why he says Iran is already well on its way to becoming a superpower. Also, States of the Union is about New Jersey. Then Roy Orbison's widow, Barbara, talks about her late husband's life and career. And Jonathan Demme will tell us about his new film, Rachel Getting Married. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Stephen Valentino. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Fran Jacobs, Jen Poyant, Carolyn Silvera, and Leslie Dickstein. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Thank you.